Bristol, For the Record, a new local oral history podcast from BCFM Radio in partnership with MShed Bristol and funded by the National Lottery Heritage Fund.
Adam Cantwell Corn was annoyed. Most major national and local newspapers are owned by corporations spouting their own agendas. Through organising and crowdfunding with local communities, Adam co-founded the Bristol Cable in 2014, which is a media co-op and newspaper, 100% owned by thousands of people holding power to account. Hi, Adam.
How's it going, Marcus?
Why is local media so important?
I guess I'm going to be a bit controversial here and say that it's not necessarily. Local media in and of itself needs to be distinguished from the various offers that are available to people. Quality local media is really important. A lot of local media that exists currently and that dominates the market isn't important. And that's kind of like where we set off from. We want it to be in the public interest. We want it to be interesting to the public. And vitally for the local media side, in regards to the like international or national media, it helps connect us and our experience and our communities to the bigger picture. And that was the way in which we approached the Bristol Cable, as being like, it's local, but we live in a nation, we live in a globalized world. So let's join the dots so that we can understand the world and our communities and our own stories around us.
How would you describe the current health and state of local media and newspapers in Bristol at the moment?
In Bristol, actually, we're pretty fortunate. You know, there's a number of different independent radio stations like BCFM. You have other newsy / lifestyle organizations of various different sorts. And Bristol, as a relatively prosperous place, is actually pretty well served. There's obviously like a lot of room for growth. There's a lot of room for sort of like more high impact public interest type journalism of various sorts, not just investigative journalism. But Bristol's doing pretty well. And in fact, like one of the things, you know, having set up the Bristol Cable, I always thought to myself is that it'd be even more important in places that doesn't have like such a rich civic society already and like active cultural and socio-political base. Like these things are even more needed in places that are like socially or economically less advantaged, and that's really important for local media as a whole to like be reaching out to those places. And the Cable's trying to find a model that can do that, but it's hard enough in Bristol as it is, so yeah, we'll see.
So relatively, local media in Bristol, you're saying, is pretty good by the sounds of it.
It's pretty good compared to most other places. Like most other a lot of other places don't have anything, or they have these sort of like zombie versions of like heritage or legacy local newspapers that are like still there. They're still printing or they're still publishing online, but most of their content is syndicated or it's about the new Aldi, or it's like just sort of like general kind of like nonsense that isn't particularly in the public interest, even though we might click on it because it's kind of like got a bit of scandal or intrigue. A lot of places, like hundreds of local newspapers, have shut down, and into that void comes disengagement, fake news, apathy, and that's something that really needs to be challenged because it's a quite a big kind of like social issue for all of us.
How and why did you get into local journalism? Can you describe your journey?
It was a bit roundabout in a way. It was essentially having been involved in the student movement in university that went from, in a, basically when the Conservative Lib Dem government got elected and the instigation of the trebling of fees and austerity and stuff like that, and becoming kind of like engaged in social political issues through that, but then becoming quite frustrated by the kind of insular nature of student politics and kind of immature nature, which I guess comes with the territory. And then myself and Alon Avaram were like, okay, we're finishing uni, it's global financial crisis, we've got some ideas of what we want to do, but don't really know exactly where to put it. Let's try to put together a bunch of different ideas and thoughts and so on that we had, which was basically community organizing, advocacy, campaigning, research, and in particular new ways of organizing and running businesses or organizations. So we put all of that together basically and came up with a media co-op, with a journalism co-op, and it's from there that Bristol Cable was born. So in a way, the journalism kind of came secondary to the kind of like social purpose of what we were trying to do. And later on, obviously, the journalism became the central product that we produced, but it was always underpinned by this kind of like value set that could have potentially gone in other ways as well.
What is the origin story of the Bristol cable? You touched upon it there, but in detail, how did it start and why? And tell us, you know, what happened?
Yeah, I mean, so it started from that basis of us wanting to do something and hitting upon this idea and then developing out that idea. In practice, it basically started with us literally writing down some bullet points on a piece of A4 paper. And then what we now know, you know, would be sort of like market research or like community engagement. But we just started doing it was basically mapping out people in the city that we thought would be interesting and important to speak to. So community people, activist people, people at the universities, people just like generally around. We would approach them, email them, phone them, approach them cold or whatever and say, look, we've got this idea, you know, we have the parameters of it, but we're inviting you to help us to sort of build it out into something that's like legitimate and like well thought through and, you know, generally something that is of and by the community. And so the first thing that we did within that spirit was host an open meeting actually right here in Eastern Community Centre. It was literally upstairs, and 30 or 40 people came to that. And then there was a really warm reception. Obviously, we got a bunch of cynics and sort of like naysayers and whatnot. But, you know, we were sort of young and naive enough to just push through it at that point. And we just went from there. And as going back to what I was saying about the kind of like community organizing principles of the Bristol Cable and the kind of like heritage of that, the first things that we actually did before publishing or before writing anything was to host a series of workshops. So all over the city, I think it was 10 or 12 different workshops, film screenings, trainings, discussions, all over from Hartcliffe to Eastern, St. Paul's, different places across the city. And it was from there that we basically made an offer to people and said, look, here's this great film or this panel conversation or this training on like smartphone journalism. And it was, we used that as a kind of like platform to pitch the idea of the Bristol Cable, recruit the first set of volunteers, and then basically started meeting in Myron Alon's living room in Easton and sort of plotting it out and making it happen. And then that was like in early 2014. And then by October 2014, we'd constituted ourselves as a cooperative. So that means we're owned democratically by our members, launched a membership scheme, launched the first print. It was free and got on our bikes and started distributing it all around the city. And then it basically went from there. You know, we didn't have any members in 2014 and now the cable has close to 3,000. So yeah.
How did you do this? Were you holding down a job at the time? Because this sounds like a lot of work.
Yeah, I mean, it was a lot of work. So it was mainly myself and Alon, and we were both working like 30, 35, 40 hours, evenings and weekends at restaurants and kitchens and waitering and stuff, and then doing this basically in the day. And that was for the first couple of years that there was no money involved at all. Like there was a little bit that we'd raised from various places to pay for some printing and stuff, but there was no salaries or wages. And that was obviously something that we were able to do by not having any major responsibilities ourselves in terms of like, you know, children and family and stuff like that. And, you know, otherwise the energy to do that being in early 20s. And so then we were really on the verge of totally burning out, actually. We'd been given a free space by PRSC in their little attic, this damp little attic, but that was brilliant. And it worked really nicely for us to move outside of the house.
What's PRSC?
PRSC is the People's Republic of Stokes Croft. It's a sort of like arts and political space in Stokes Croft. And Chris Chalkley, the legendary front person of it, came to one of our meetings and said, look, I've got this, you know, little attic room, you can have it. And we were like, yeah, great, nice. But we were on the verge of burning out, and then we got some significant funding, and then that enabled us to sort of start paying ourselves, you know, not legal wages really at that point. You know, you become your own worst boss when you're in a cooperative, but there's no boss to sort of complain to apart from yourself. And that sort of saved us from kind of calling it off, basically, because it was becoming a bit of a strain to do all of that work and on relationships and friendships and just running out of steam. But got some funding, and then it kind of like started to professionalize and become a much more serious operation from then. And that was in late 2015.
How does a media co-op work and function, the legal entity? Like, what, how does it work?
I mean, so the basics of a cooperative is that it's owned democratically. So like within a normal company, and in particular, like in shareholding based organizations, if you own 100 shares, say you have 100 votes. In a cooperative, it's owned democratically, so it's one person, one share, and one vote. And the way it works at the cable is that basically, if you imagine a sort of like a funnel, you have at the top of the widest part of the funnel, you have all of the members, which is now getting up close to 3,000 members or so. And they are the legal owners of the organization, and they help steer the big picture stuff. So strategy, prioritization of what sort of stories we should do, grappling with ethical issues about like where we might take funding from or our advertising charter. And then they, biggest group then, would give a steer to the operational team, which is a small team. Now it's of like 8 full-time equivalent people. And they would basically take the mandate from the members, also organized as a kind of workers co-op, and then interpret that and then turn that into like an actual operational plan. So the members would give the steer, and then the workforce, the team would actually turn it into a reality. And so there's this kind of like relationship between, you know, the democratic base, which is all of the members, and then the actual team itself, which is also organized as a workers co-op where we make decisions collectively.
Why did you decide to go for this model?
A few reasons. The biggest one comes kind of back to the first point about like the quality of local journalism that is available. And one of the things that is really important to note is that most local journalism now isn't really local. It's owned first by major corporations. So in the UK, 4 or 5 corporations own like 70-80% of local, so-called local journalism. And those corporations in themselves are then owned by international hedge funds and asset managers and investment managers and banks and pension funds and so on. And so what's happened is there's been a big dislocation between the communities and the people that local journalism is meant to solve and the owners of it. And what that means is that when there's a sort of like, as there has been perpetually in journalism now for like 20 years, a kind of financial crisis in how sustainable it is, the owner's response is to be like, oh, profits are down, so we're not going to invest and create a better product or invest in the workforce, is to gut and to cut and to reduce the cost, which therefore reduces the quality of the operation. That in turn obviously affects people's trust, because if it's no good, then people don't trust it. And then people start shutting off and not paying for it, which obviously turns back into more cuts and a bit of a cyclical downturn. So all of that's a roundabout way to be saying is that basically, like, we felt that the way in which to kind of gain the support of the people that we were trying to win over and become paying members, so paying pound or more a month, was to be as close to them as possible. And so that meant being legally owned by them, inviting and facilitating their direct democratic participation in what we were doing to the greatest extent possible, and being 100% transparent and organized in a way that is also not for profit, which means that any money that we're making is going directly into what we're trying to do.
If the Bristol Cable, as you say, is non-profit and a media co-op, how do you generate income then to pay staff and to do what the cable does?
The way we do that is, first of all, through membership. So on average, the membership is about £3.50 a month. Some pay quite a bit more. Some pay the minimum, which is £1 a month to be a member. Obviously, the proportions have changed a bit over time, but that covers about 40% of, just under 40% of the cable's expenditure, income and expenditure. And the rest of it is covered through various grants and funding, the majority of which comes from 2 US-based sort of like socially orientated philanthropic organizations. And the reason why they fund us is not because they care about Bristol or the Bristol Cable in itself, but they care about how different organizations, because they fund other things, can sort of like drive forward innovation and development and progress in a sector that's been so beset by sort of like failing business models, by them being playthings for billionaires, and the social and like political consequences of that. So we've received and been really fortunate to win and receive funding like that of various different sorts that's enabled us to continue paying our staff, to do the training programs that we do, to print the copies, to pay for our rent, and so on. In the long term, the idea is to have it 100% funded by members. And that is obviously the goal. But it's a very, very difficult market. It's not like people aren't used to paying for journalism, particularly people of a you know, younger generations. And but that's the case that we're trying to make, is that it's, you're not just paying for journalism, you're paying to be support and be part of a community and a growing international movement as well, to kind of push back and fight back against the big tech platforms that have sucked so much money out of journalism and advertising masquerading as journalism, and obviously the sort of, like, you know, Rupert Murdoch's and whatnot of this world that use it as a, you know, a political tool to advance pretty nefarious aims.
Over the years of running the Bristol Cable, what are some of your most proud highlights and achievements?
I think one of the proudest achievements is probably embodied within our annual general meetings, which sounds really boring, and we have to fight to find to make them not boring, which involves at least some samosas, but definitely some participatory engagement from members to grapple with different issues and to understand that a lot of the work of building a kind of new journalism outfit is not just about the journalism and the writing, but it's about the operational stuff. It's about the strategy. It's about the ethics and all of these sorts of things. So obviously before COVID, we would have in really vibrant general meetings, or we'd have 120, 130 people come and we'd thrash out really interesting ideas about what we should prioritize, whether or not we should take money from different certain organizations, and actually built like a really vibrant community around something that traditionally is, as we know, is a bit of a preserve of kind of like privately educated white London journalists who sort of grant access to information, you know, through the sort of like big titles and stuff like that. And we were basically totally turning that on its head and being like, this is a community endeavor, and, you know, and it will be built that way, and it will be really, really good quality as well. Which brings us to the next point, which is like the quality, some of the quality journalism that we've done. You know, we're a small outfit, local outfit, but we've been recognized nationally and internationally for doing really hard-hitting investigative journalism, from tax havens to an award-winning five-year investigation that uncovered modern-day slavery type activity in Bristol itself, to a long-standing series on the housing crisis, which forced Bristol City Council to change their policy on divulging confidential information about housing affordability stuff. Bailiffs equally helped to change the practice of the City Council on a heavy-handed debt collection. And there's other stuff that's kind of less easy to measure, but like the training programs that we've done, the trying to, and there's still a lot more to do, but like trying to like bring through different and diverse voices in the city to get into a world that is kind of like notoriously elitist.
So as you mentioned there, in 2019, the Bristol Cable won the Press Gazette British Journalism Award for local journalism, noting your five-year investigation into modern slavery by a local employer. Can you just tell us what that story was all about?
Yeah, so actually this is a really great one actually for this podcast, which is about the history of the Cable. This story has its origins at the very, very beginning when Alon and I were working in kitchens, and the first investigation that we decided to do was looking at working conditions, workers' rights and so on within the catering sector, because we were working there and, you know, it's not exactly sort of like high quality work. So we were doing that. We were asking people about their experiences of working in different places. We surveyed lots of people and tried to collect some data and also some qualitative stories. And one person that Alon was working with in a kitchen was like, oh, you need to look into the Le Presti business. And so the Le Presti business is a very long-standing, decades-old business in the city, various like property holdings and business interests, but most famously known for its ice cream and various ice cream vans dotted across the place. So that was in 2014. And then we basically started looking into this, and it was a slow burn, as often this work can be. But in short, it involved gathering lots of different information, finding out their property interests through digging through various paperwork and data, finding out about how they were actually treating workers, which involved having somebody go undercover within the organization and finding themselves being paid an absolute fraction of the minimum wage. And then a much darker or more serious side emerged, which we'd heard sort of rumors from that we started to dig around, that there was actually a person and potentially two people that were being held in much more serious conditions than at serious, but not, you know, as serious as wage exploitation, but something that was akin to sort of like involuntary servitude or domestic servitude. So over a period of about a year, we investigated this, tracked down various people, and discovered that it was the case that there were people living and being held against their will by Salvatore Lopresti, the sort of patriarch of this family. We, through various conversations with people, and given the seriousness of the issue, we were advised by lots of different people, and this wasn't an easy decision, but for the welfare of the individuals, was to raise this with the police. Did raise this with the police. They took forever to investigate it, which is, I think, something that is not really acceptable. But eventually, they brought the case to trial for prosecution on modern day slavery offences of Salvatore Lopresti and his son, Robert. The trial basically went on, and we obviously covered the trial, and in the meantime had been investigating this whole story, and basically we uncovered literally dozens of people going back to the 80s that had been physically assaulted, economically exploited, or had been victims of some landlordism of Salvatore Lopresti. And, you know, we had to sort of bring all that together, and that formed the basis for the prosecution.
Amazing. So for that investigation, you ended up making the headlines yourself, didn't you?
Yeah, the Bristol Cable did. It was a pretty big story locally, and then sort of got out nationally, and we invested in the distribution of it, because people think of modern day slavery as something other than something that might happen on a Bristol high street, on Bedminster High Street, very close to East Street. So we got it out there, and then it got picked up basically in various different places, and we worked with the BBC to distribute it as well. And then eventually, yeah, we were nominated and awarded the British Journalism Award 2019, which was a really great moment.
Are there any other stories or breaking stories that jump out at you that you're proud of as well, or made an impact?
There's obviously been a lot. I think we did a really good series. My colleague Hannah did a really good series on travellers and like Gypsy Roma travellers, which obviously are like the subject of quite a lot of like prejudice or like misconceptions and whatnot all over the country. And we basically were like, okay, these are actually people too, and like maybe there's some issues here we need to discuss, but like let's go out and actually find their stories and not have it all mediated through like, you know, right-wing press or like there's a traveler encampment on the downs. Like let's actually find out what's going on here and like try to understand it. And that's also been the big kind of like thread of the Cable's journalism. It's like not just what is going on, but why is this happening, how can it move forward. And that we also did a series on solutions journalism, so we looked at like reforming the bus services, which I know is a nightmare for lots of people, retrofitting council houses. And so it wasn't all just sort of like everything bleak. We also tried to do some more like positive stuff as well, including like culture and like highlighting different community organizations and individuals that actually making a really good contribution to making Bristol great.
The Bristol Cable just don't write stories. You also produce podcasts and make documentaries. Can you tell us more about this other branch of the organisation?
So you know a bit about this. I think one of the best documentaries we've created was Viral, which was about vaccine scepticism and COVID scepticism that we made in Bristol. And similarly, there was so much furore about it. And we went out and we actually spoke to the people, and like we're not there to kind of say that vaccine skepticism or COVID denialism is valid. We're just actually going to investigate what's happening out in our society. So yeah, we made a great short documentary on that. And we also have a series, podcast series called Bristol Unpacked, which is hosted by Neil Maggs, who's known man about town. And voice of Bristol, or I like to joke about him called, and that's speaking to lots of different interesting people, from politicians, cultural people in the city, activists, sports people, and trying to like get under the skin of some issues and individuals in the city in a kind of like long form conversational way. You know, we don't do, you know, in that sense anyway, like gotcha journalism or like soundbite stuff. Like we're interested in the depth and the colour, and Bristol Unpacked does that really well.
Surely it hasn't been all plain sailing to create a media organisation. What have been some of the low points?
Just in general, it's in many cases been really, really tiring, but you know, lots of work is tiring. I think some of the low points, I guess, came about because we were like new to running an organisation and new to running this sort of organisation, a kind of media cooperative that really doesn't have that many blueprints or like examples to follow. And so like sometimes there was like conflict in the team, or there was disputes about which way to go forward. And that was really, you know, it's hard work, but it comes with the territory sometimes of trying to do something new and challenging. And now the organization, I think, is in a really good place in terms of its culture and how it's run. Other low points, I guess, have been that like I would want it to be like much bigger than it is now. You know, we've got a few thousand members and that's really great, and everyone of them is making this happen. But if the cable is considered kind of like the outstanding example kind of globally for this sort of organization, and we're still sort of like struggling, so that's kind of a bit of a challenge to confront and be like, okay, we're doing this pretty well, better than most, and it's still really hard to make this work financially, and you know, to sort of like get people over the line and to become, move from kind of like being tacit supporters or in principle supporters to kind of like really reaching in and getting out their card and like, you know, committing to the organization. And, you know, that's our responsibility to do, but it also signals the challenges of the overall sector of like, we need quality local and general public interest journalism. And I always say to people, if we don't pay for it, as in like we, the collective we, then somebody else will, and they already do. Rupert Murdoch is paying for it when we don't, because they know its value and they know how powerful it is. And if we want that value and we want that power, then we need to pay for it and support it. But that's not that easy an argument to make, particularly, you know, with times are hard and stuff. So yeah.
There are some local politicians that don't really like the Bristol Cable, is there? And you haven't been invited to certain briefings or conferences. Can you tell us more about that situation?
Not our job really to be liked by local politicians, you know. Obviously it should be cordial and professional, and it generally is. But yeah, I mean, the Bristol Cable hasn't or wasn't invited, or was actively disinvited or not allowed to attend Marvin Rees's weekly briefings. And we weren't that bothered by it, to be honest. Like, they're a bit sort of like set piece, like boring. And also there's other people that are doing that work, like the local democracy reporters. And obviously there was a bit of a furore recently when Marvin Rees decided that they were banned, or that they weren't banned, they just weren't invited. You know, whatever the distinction between that is, I don't know. And look, like, you know, public life should be contested. It shouldn't be, you know, sort of like fever pitch level and everything else, but it also shouldn't be cozy. Like a lot of journalism, particularly, you know, the sort of like access-based journalism, or, you know, take a minister out for dinner journalism, is too cozy. And that's not something that we're sort of like keen to be in the business of doing, because that's when you get kind of like groupthink, or people becoming disconnected from a lot of the rest of the country because they're just in SW1, or, you know, it obviously doesn't happen really in Bristol, but, you know, sort of just in the orbit of being given access to the powers that be, and then denied that access if you don't play by the rules that they set. So yeah, it should always be professional and cordial. And, you know, I was holding my hands up on a couple of occasions where I haven't been that, but, you know, that's a process of maturing as well. And I invite all local politicians to do the same.
Talking about hanging out with politicians, you were recently invited by members of parliament to share your views on the sustainability of local journalism. What did you tell them?
I told them that the nibbling around the edges of a like systemic crisis within the market and business model and economics of journalism is not going to be enough. If they want to address factors or situations where huge parts of the population are just withdrawing from journalism altogether in this phenomenon called news avoidance, or sort of falling prey to fake news, or you know, just being sort of like carried along by the kind of like scandal and outrage machine in various different ways, then there needs to be the conditions created that support the financial viability of public interest journalism. And that means various things. So like tax incentives for public interest or not-for-profit journalism. It means reviewing the curriculum and career pathway for new people starting into journalism, which isn't just reporters and journalists, although that's really important, but it's also newsroom managers and product managers and community engagement specialists and software and computer programmers. All of that is part of the ecosystem of modern journalism. It's not like men in trench coats with notepads. You know, it's really evolved. You know, I think it was good that they were interested in this inquiry into the future of local news and the sustainability of it. But I can't say that I was massively encouraged by the way in which they were thinking about it, which was near obsession with clickbait, but understanding clickbait as just something people do to muddy the waters of, you know, society and public conversation, when really it's to do with the economics of the business model, in that advertising, digital advertising, is so basically worthless. News publishers have to get hundreds of thousands of people to look at their articles in order to make any money from it, because you get a fraction of a penny from that little article that floats down past your screen. And so their incentive is to jack up the sort of like scandal and the outrage, and press down on the quality and the money and the expense and the resources that go into producing it, which comes back to the beginning of where we started, which is about ownership and the interests and what's the actual purpose of local journalism. It's not just any other commodity for, you know, a global investment bank to invest in. It's actually something that we need, actually, like any other public service. If we're going to have a healthy community and healthy democracy, we need this to be sort of like protected and defended and built upon in the same way as anything else.
Moving forwards, how do you see the future of local journalism?
So in many ways, there's some really interesting green shoots, or even more advanced things, particularly across Europe. There's a bigger and better understanding of the kind of the issues, like those I just spoke about, like the economics and stuff, as well as actually how to engage different groups and audiences, particularly those that have been historically or currently underserved by journalism, which obviously is a large part of the population. And there's a kind of growing coalition, formal and informal, of people doing this work, researching it, funding it, supporting it to happen. But that's sort of pushing back against a bit of a tide of not so good news, which is a sort of like doubling down and continuation of the corporate models that's seeing further consolidation, further cuts, further closures, and so on. And obviously the pandemic itself was called a media extinction event because nobody was advertising anymore, which meant that lots of journalism, corporate journalism, really wasn't getting funded. And the response to that has not been to, as a rule, has not been to invest in better quality journalism or really go for a new business model, but has been to sort of cut and consolidate and, you know, redundancies and so on. And we think we're going to see more of that. There are like some really interesting stuff out there, and that means that there's some stuff that we can kind of get behind and support. And a lot of it's not perfect. Like, cable is far from perfect, but, you know, most things are not perfect. We've got to, and thing about something like the cable is that you can support it, but you can also influence it to be improved in that way, and it can make it accountable to what, you know, you want, or what you think that is needed. So, you know, that's the way, is to recenter the audience, think about the public again, move away from advertising and bring ownership and accountability like closer to the audience it's meant to serve.
So you've recently left the Bristol Cable, in other words, handed over your baby. Why did you decide now is the time to go? And what does the future hold for you?
So I decided to leave because, well, one of the things that Alon and I said from the beginning was, is that a good sign of the organization's success would it be able to outlive anybody, any individual, but in particular its founders. And so some of the work that I've been doing with colleagues, obviously, and very closely with some really great colleagues, has been trying to strengthen the organization in terms of how it's run and like recruitment and stuff like that, to have better systems and processes so it doesn't just rely on individuals. You know, we'll see how much that works, and I have faith in the team to carry that forward. But it felt like it was time for me to move on in that sense. It also felt on a personal level that like I'd been doing something for 8.5 years and I was ready for something new. I'm not at the moment continuing into journalism. I'm looking more at kind of sort of like policy and like politics stuff, which kind of loops back to where this actually began, is that I have a really big soft spot for journalism, but I see journalism as an important part of kind of contributing to like social and political life. And I'm exploring other ways on how to do that now for myself, but with the same sort of like ethos and values that underpin it.
Adam Cantwell-Corn, thank you so much.
Thank you, Marcus.
Cheers.
Cheers, then.